What are the secrets behind the clothes we wear? Here's one.
When you see the price of a t-shirt today and it's $10, you can generally say that the person who made it was paid 10 cents. And that the people who are making all the money in this chain of events is the owners and the shareholders of these companies. The monthly rate for workers, garment workers, was $68. $68 a month. And the second richest man in the world was the owner of Zara, and he possessed $68 billion.
That's journalist and author Dana Thomas. We talk with her about the young reader's edition of her book, Fashionopolis. Then we air some clips from our 2008 interview with energy and security analyst Michael Clare, where we speak about Russia as a petrostate, its war with Georgia, and the geopolitics of energy. The relevance to what's happening today with Russia's assault on Ukraine is striking. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice, in-depth conversation with writers of all genres, on the air since 2004. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station and at writersvoice.net. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Did you know that the average number of times people wear a piece of clothing they've bought is 7? That's just one of the many shocking facts behind fast fashion I learned from reading Dana Thomas's book, Fashionopolis. The original book came out in 2020, and the publisher, Penguin Random House, asked Thomas to follow up with a version for young readers, middle school to high school. That's just been issued. Dana Thomas wants young readers to understand what's at stake when they get caught up in the allure of the fast fashion world, the cost to workers, and the planet. She also has a lot to say about slow fashion, ways to produce great clothes without killing or maiming people and the earth. Her book is Fashionopolis, The Secrets Behind the Clothes We Wear. Well, Dana Thomas, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thanks for having me.
This book, Fashionopolis, it's really a terrific book. It's about fast fashion and also the remedies for it. I found, you know, I know something about fast fashion, but I was shocked to the bottom of my soul by some of the facts. In the first few pages of this book, I mean, for one thing, that the average number of times that people wear a fast fashion item is 7 and 3 in China. So tell us just some of those shocking facts about this industry before we get into some of the stories that you tell in the book.
Well, yeah, it's not just in a fast fashion garment. All clothing, the average garment in general, is worn 7 times before it's thrown away. And given that I have some things that I've worn, you know, until they're shiny and the lining is shredded, that means there's a lot of clothes that are being thrown away without ever being worn. And, you know, some of the other figures that are just so astounding are that we produce about 100 billion fashion items every year. That's a rough estimate because nobody has a firm number because the whole system is so opaque, it's really hard to peg. But it's between, you know, between sort of 90 and 120 billion. So we just say 100 to keep it easy. And only 80% of those clothes are sold. 20%, meaning 20 billion items, are destroyed before they even hit the retail floor. And we saw evidence of this shockingly, horrifyingly this fall when there were pictures. Al Jazeera published a story about the desert in Chile, the driest desert in the world, along the coast of Chile, where 35,000 tons, I believe, of fast fashion with price tags still on it, never sold, just directly left over from the store, is dumped in this desert every year. And that there are dunes of unsold clothes rotting, not really rotting, but baking in the sun, because 60% or more of all of our clothes have polyester in them. And polyester is essentially plastic. It's petroleum based. So it never biodegrades. It never breaks down. It just sort of bakes in the sun. And this beautiful, once pristine desert is now covered in dunes of clothes.
That is just horrifying. You have many examples in this book, Dana Thomas, in Fashionopolis, about what happens to a piece of clothing. I mean, a lot of this, I'd say the first half of this book is really about the supply chain. The second half of the book, I'm happy to say, is about the alternatives to the current system. But tell us what happens to, say, a cotton t-shirt from start to finish.
Well, you know, it's interesting how you said about half the book. What I tried to do is my structure for the book is a bit like A Christmas Carol by Charles Dickens, where we have the ghost of Christmas past, the ghost of Christmas present, the ghost of Christmas future. But in my book, it's the ghost of fashion past, the ghost of fashion present, and the ghost of fashion future. And the ghost of fashion past, of course, is about the Industrial Revolution and how we've had this really bad system now for about 250 years of sweatshops and factory fires, and that, you know, as the French say, the plus ça change, the more that changes, the more it stays the same. And then the present, ghost of fashion present, is that we still have some bad stuff going on, like factory collapses in Bangladesh and sweatshops in LA, but we also have some cool things that are being that are coming up, like regenerating polyester and cotton back to their cellular levels, and then and creating new fabric from them, recycling, and all these really cool movements. And then the fashion future, of course, is like all the really cool things happening in labs, like growing leather from DNA and growing silk from yeast, and you know, trying to figure out ways to and the return of organic cotton and the return of natural indigo, and how these things are, you know, going to do really cool thing, and 3D printing, and how everything could change sort of in a sci-fi way. So today, a cotton t-shirt, you know, the traditional cotton t-shirt is made of conventional cotton, which is one of the most polluting crops there is. And it's been manhandled and genetically modified and just, you know, turned into this Franken crop in a sense, where it requires an enormous amount of chemicals and an enormous amount of water. Though naturally, organically, cotton is one of the sturdiest plants out there that doesn't need fertilizers and it doesn't need water. It actually, when it cotton plant blooms, the ball is it's called, the cotton ball, B-O-L-L, blooms on the tree and you get the little poof of cotton. That happens when the plant is stressed. So it actually likes drought and it likes heat. And that's why we've always grown cotton in places like Texas and California and the Egyptian desert in India. You know, we're not growing it in England, so, you know, where it rains all the time, or Ireland. So, but it's been genetically created to drink more water there, to therefore to produce six times more cotton per plant than before, and that just ravages the soil. And traditionally, a 1 kilo of conventional cotton requires 1 kilo of chemicals, which is just mind blowing, right? And then it would be spun and woven in a factory, probably where people are not paid a living wage, because 98% of factory workers in the garment business today are not paid a living wage, which means they are not paid what economists have calculated for where they live, not just generally speaking, but for where they live, what is the minimum that they are required to earn to able to house, clothe, and feed themselves and their families. So generally they make about half of that. So they work overtime that's unpaid. They have no benefits. I mean, maternity leave, you know, what a laugh. And healthcare, what a laugh. You just work and work and work and you bring home half of what you need and you get paid once a month. So then the t-shirt would also be sewn by them. It would be shipped around the world, because all this happens most of the time in Southeast Asia, though sometimes it's in Central America or in Ethiopia, where they're paid. When I was working on the book, I think they were paid $24 a month, being the lowest you could have, the lowest rate of income in the garment industry in the world. And it winds up in a big warehouse after being shipped around the world on ships that just, you know, are highly polluting, and is trucked to your store where it's sold, and then marked down if it isn't sold, and marked down. And then if it isn't sold, it's destroyed or winds up in the desert. Now, when you see the price of a t-shirt today and it's $10, you can generally say that the person who made it was paid 10 cents. And that the people who are making all the money in this chain of events is the owners and the shareholders of these companies. When I was working on the book in Bangladesh, the monthly rate for workers, garment workers, was $68. $68 a month. And the second richest man in the world was the owner of Zara, and he possessed $68 billion. So that shows you how you can get wildly rich on the fingers of these people while you're, you know, squeezing the supply chain. So we've never paid so little for clothes. You keep hearing and reading in newspapers about inflation. Well, I can tell you it's not happening in fashion. A generation ago, we bought one-fifth. We buy five times more clothes than we did a generation ago, 30 years ago. And the average cost is half the amount that it was 30 years ago.
Wow. And you're just adding now, I mean, these are not even in the book, some of the last things that you've said.
Right. They're in the grown-up book. I mean, I'm terrible at algebra, but even I can see that train leaving the station, it's not the same train as the other train leaving the station, right? That, you know, in 1980, we bought one-fifth the number of clothes that we buy today, and we paid twice as much for them out of our annual budget. We had a much bigger slice of the pie dedicated to buying fashion when I was in high school than I am today. And people complain that they can't afford to pay more for clothes, but in fact, we can. We've just been conditioned to think we can't because clothes have become so cheap and so disposable.
Exactly. As you said, they're disposable. You know, they fall apart pretty quickly, a lot of them.
Throw away clothes.
Right. If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Dana Thomas about the young reader's version of her book, Fashionopolis. It's a great read for grown-ups as well as for kids. So, you know, you talk a bit about the history of ready-to-wear, which I found very interesting. And talk also about the working conditions. I mean, you've talked about the incredibly poor pay. Talk also about the working conditions that people are laboring under. And is this actually getting worse?
Well, it's getting worse and better. So I went to visit two sweatshops for this book on two different continents. The first one was in Bangladesh, and I was in that sweatshop within half an hour of stepping off the plane. That's how many there are. And I was told that it was not a particularly bad one, and I was horrified by the situation. The walls were covered with slop and dirt and filth. Everyone was thin and tired looking, barefoot. They all worked barefoot on these unfinished floors. So, you know, I can't imagine. I guess they have calluses, so they aren't getting splinters, but yikes. They were working with really archaic machinery. The one staircase was encumbered with gigantic boxes. The windows had bars on them, so if there was a fire, you couldn't get out except down that staircase that was filled with all these huge boxes of clothes to ship. The bins that are supposed to hold water to put out fires were empty and cracked and filled with trash. There were no fire extinguishers. And, you know, you say, oh, well, how often is there a fire? Well, actually, in garment factories, there's fires a lot because fabrics are very combustible and people smoke in them. So, and then of course the wiring, I mean, let's not even get into the wiring that was just dangling from ceilings and not, you know, and it like terrifying. I mean, it was just, I thought I had been flung back to the time of Charles Dickens and Oliver Twist, and the workers were 14 years old. So, and they were making jeans for a brand I'd heard of. And when you went on their website, they had this pictures of this gleaming, beautiful factory and people sitting at beautiful modern sewing machines and under white lights, and everything was shiny and clean, and everybody looked healthy and well. And I'm like, I don't know where that picture came from because it's not where I am. And so, you know, you can source from that place. And if you've never visited it, you have no idea. And I would say most companies that do their sourcing like that from Bangladesh, they never get on a plane and go to Bangladesh. They have agents on the ground who assure them that this is all fine and this is who they should be doing business with. And they've never stepped foot into the factory. And if they do sourced from one factory, that factory can subcontract it to a place like this. And that's what I saw also in the other place I visited were sweatshops, which was Los Angeles. In the heart of downtown Los Angeles, you know, blocks away from Disney Hall, I went into a building called the Bendix Building, open to the public. There's studios and art galleries and dance studios. And, you know, it's a cheap old building from the 1920s, beautiful deco building. But there's also lots of sweatshops and people are sitting in there sewing clothes from brands you've heard of. And when I went there, it's brands like Ross for Less and Forever 21. And I can't remember some of the other names, but, you know, American brands. Now they're being made in these sweatshops and several of these brands have been busted by the Labor Department. And they always say, this is not our problem because the people we contracted to subcontracted to this sweatshop and we had no idea. Now it's one thing if you can't keep a hold of your supply chain on the other side of the world because you don't go to Bangladesh. But if you're an LA-based brand and you don't know where your clothes are being made when they're being made in downtown LA, then you're just not, I don't know what it's either really bad business or you're not being honest because, you know, you should be able to track your own supply chain within the city limits. And they are so hyper about things like if the seam is sewed right, if the color is right, if the buttons are on right, how can they not be hyper about where the clothes are made to and who makes them? So since then, the good news is, yes, in Bangladesh, it's even more of a disaster after COVID, because so many brands canceled their orders, even in legitimate factories, that there are millions and millions and millions and millions of dollars owed to factories and therefore to workers for work they'd already done. And the clothes were made and just sat on the docks rotting because the stores are like, what are we going to do with clothes? All these clothes are, now we have to close our store for 6 months or a year with lockdowns. And so the workers were sent home without pay and many of them were starving. And it was just a horror. But in LA, the California legislature passed a law in September saying that the brands can no longer say this is not our problem if the workers making our clothes aren't paid the state minimum wage, because most of those workers in those sweatshops are paid about $2 an hour when the state minimum wage is nearly $15 an hour. I'm not quite sure if it's made up to, but they've been working their way up to the $15 an hour and the federal is $7.25 or $7.50. So, you know, not even close to the federal minimum wage. And they used to say, not our problem. And the state of California says, you know what? It is your problem. And now they're holding those brands liable for what is called wage theft, which will, in theory, crack down and eliminate the sweatshop in Los Angeles. When they get busted, the brands are held accountable and they don't want to lose that money and they don't want that bad press.
You know, one of the things that shocked me about this is that these brands can put on the made in the USA label, which
exactly.
is a label. This is a label that people will pay a little extra for made in the USA because they think, okay, it costs more, but people are getting paid better.
Exactly. But in fact, it's still made in the sweatshop. The only clothes that are, I mean, not only, but most of the clothes made in the USA that are made in a upstanding factory where everyone is paid, you know, union wages and have benefits and health care and maternity leave and paid vacation, are military contractors because they have to be because it's the law.
You're listening to Writer's Voice, and we're talking with Dana Thomas about her young readers' version of her book, Fashionopolis, The Secrets Behind the Clothes We Wear. You know, you mentioned Bangladesh, and I wonder if you could tell us the story of the Rana factory catastrophe in Bangladesh. And, you know, it was not the first. There was the Tazreen factory fire that went on before that and other fire before then, each catastrophe worse than the last. I'd like you to tell us what happened there and what was the response of the brands?
Well, there's factory fires and factory collapses all the time in India and Bangladesh and Vietnam and in China. It's just that they don't always make the papers because there aren't so many deaths. With the Rana Plaza factory collapse, that was an enormous building. It took up an entire city block in the town of outside of Dhaka in Savar. And more than 1,000 people were killed and more than 2,000 people were injured. And not just injured, but I mean permanently disabled. And, you know, it's not like they just broke their wrist. They're, you know, bedridden. And I went to see some of the victims, the survivors, on the anniversary of the factory collapse. And, you know, I met a woman who was in her mid-20s now, and she was bedridden, and she lives in a shanty on a wooden plank platform bed, you know, no mattress, just wood. And her entire insides were crushed. And so she is, you know, incontinent, and she is barren, and she can't walk, and her husband has to look after her. And, you know, do you think she got anything from anybody for any of that, from the brands, from the state, from anything? Nope. So, you know, and just because she was at her job, sitting at a sewing machine when the factory collapsed. So the factory collapsed. It was shoddy built. The owner had ignored building permits and paid off, you know, bribed officials to green light things and let him build extra floors when he shouldn't have. And he did everything on the cheap. He was, you know, a real thug, this guy. And the factory one day just rumbled and collapsed. And, you know, the stories that I heard, people telling me, you know, all these years later, you know, that they were, you know, on the fifth floor, and suddenly they found themselves in this rubble. It took, you know, days for them to be pulled out. They were in comas for weeks. You know, they're on crutches now. They still have nightmares. Some of them have been so desperate for work, they went back to work in garment factories. Talk about PTSD. None of them got any money in any compensation whatsoever. And then a bit like the Vietnam War, then there's the suicides that come after because people are so tormented by the whole thing or depressed. So it was just a horrible, horrible thing. And yet, you know, it still goes on. It still goes on. You just don't hear about them if you read the trade journals, you read about a fire about once a week, but nobody's killed, or two or three people are killed, or it happened in the middle of the night, or everyone got out, you know, it's hairy. I mean, and you think back, that's what I was saying about Le Plus Ça Change. You know, there was the famous Triangle Shirtwaist Factory fire in downtown New York about 100 years ago, a bit more than 100 years ago now. And, you know, history repeated itself almost exactly a century later with the Tazreen fire in Bangladesh, where more than 100 people were killed and people were jumping out of windows and all the fire exits were locked because, you know, the factory owners locked the fire exits so workers won't steal. They believe the workers will steal product and then sell it on the black market. Not that there's that great a black market in Bangladesh. And honestly, I mean, I've met these people and they are not, you know, hoodlums. They're hardworking poor. And they're not looking for shortcuts. They're just trying to do a good job and they have a bit of pride in their work. So, you know, and pride in themselves. So they're not the sort that would steal the jeans. And even if they did, I mean, come on, how much more are they going to sell them for? And how, I mean, the $68 billion owner of Zara can lose a few pairs of jeans every month to workers who aren't making ends meet because they don't pay them enough. Of course, all of this, as this activist said in the 19th century, could all be eliminated if they simply paid workers what they're worth and they upgraded technology to state of the art. Everything would run smoother. Everything would be better, would be more efficient in its production. And there would be no reason to fear a theft because everybody would be well paid. And then you wouldn't have these tragedies and you wouldn't have to lock the escape hatches and the fire exits and put up bars on the windows. It's all, you know, it's all a vicious circle.
You know, one of the things that you point out is that it's not even cheaper necessarily because you're having the designing in one place, the cutting in another place, the sewing together in another place. You know, in other words, it's like our food. You know, you'll catch a fish in the North Atlantic. It'll be flown to China where it's filleted, and then it's flown back to the United States. This is the same kind of thing with globalization.
The false economy, that's what one of the designers called it in the book, the false economy. That, you know, if you look at the columns and you say we're cutting prices here, we're saving money here, but then you're sending somebody first class to Hong Kong for a meeting, you're not really saving money.
So we've talked about fast fashion, and there's much more in the book. I mean, just what happens to jeans in Vietnam was another eye-opener. But let's go on to...
The part about hope.
Exactly. Let's go on to slower fashion. And you're right. You know, the book is a third, a third, a third. But I was so impressed by what people are doing to really radically change this industry to make it more sustainable that I almost felt like it was half of the book. It was so striking. So first of all, we talked about cotton before. Talk about cotton.
Well, there's great things happening in cotton, and particularly in the world of blue jeans. You know, blue jeans are the one thing we wear more than anything else, except maybe underwear and socks. And we produce 6 billion pairs of blue jeans every year. And the irony of blue jeans is that when they were invented to be the most sustainable garment of all time. Those rivets that are at the corner of your pockets aren't there for decoration. They were there to hold the seams together to make them more sturdy. And these pants were invented for miners during the California gold rush who were crawling around on the earth all day. and if they struck gold, then they gave their jeans to the next guy who was coming along and trying to get some gold or some silver in the mines. And so they were passed on down to down, and they were never washed, and they were just sturdy, sturdy pants. So now that they've become this fashion item that we burn through at a couple of months, and that they crack open, and you know, we buy them already destroyed, it's kind of, you know, they've kind of lost their way along in their almost 200 year or 150 year existence. So the thing that now today, 99% of blue jeans are dyed with synthetic indigo, which when it was invented, like so many things in the early 20th century and the late 19th century, we thought was genius, because natural indigo, while it's great in its color and its beauty, is a crop. And so you could only grow it certain periods of the year, that it was, you know, that you had to be, you know, it could get wiped out by a storm, it could get wiped out by disease, it could get wiped out by drought, you know, there was a lot of variables. And synthetic indigo, you could make it today and use it today, and it would be look exactly like yesterday. Natural indigo would have different color changes because every crop was different, every place on every bit of earth was different. So it was steady, it was reliable, the variables were taken out, and therefore it was cheaper because you didn't have to pay insurance and all those other things. And so it became the thing. Well, it turns out, looking back now, synthetic indigo is incredibly toxic. It's made with things like, has chemicals in it like formaldehyde and cyanide. I always joke that, you know, in those old war movies, when you have somebody with like a cyanide pill in their special ring, and if they're captured, they're supposed to take the cyanide pill and kill themselves. Well, you could just eat your jeans. So, yeah, you don't need the cyanide pill. You're wearing the stuff against your skin. And of course, you wash it and it goes all into our water systems. It has benzene, it has aniline, really terrible chemicals that are not great for the environment or even damaging to the environment. And you times that by 6 billion pairs a year, you're starting to get some serious impact on Mother Nature and on the planet. So there's great news in that the natural indigo industry, thanks to one hard-headed, incredibly savvy and ambitious young woman in Tennessee named Sarah Bellows, has decided to bring this back to an industrial level. And she has just worked out a deal with Levi's to bring natural indigo back into the industrial supply chain for blue jeans. And she's growing this indigo in Tennessee in the old tobacco fields, because the tobacco industry has collapsed since people are smoking less in America. And it's great because indigo is one of those plants like soybean. It's a legume that puts nitrogen back in the soil. And tobacco is like corn. It leaches nutrients enormously from the soil. So if you've been growing tobacco on this earth for years and years, centuries, that soil is dead. But a couple seasons of indigo and it's back to life, and the biodiversity comes back, and it's fabulous. Indigo is also naturally bitter, so bugs don't really like it. So if you plant indigo around your other crops, then you don't have to spray herbicides or pesticides on your crops, because the indigo is a natural repellent. But more than that, it's just beautiful. beautiful, beautiful. So that's one of the stories of hope, that we're going to get really beautiful natural indigo jeans back in our closets and on and out in the streets again, and they will have less of an impact on humanity and the planet, which I just love.
Dana Thomas. Stay tuned for more of our conversation after the break. That was the song Fast Fashion, Too Fast for You by Sophie Klimt and sung by the students of Christopher Hatton Primary School. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. We're talking with Dana Thomas about her young reader's version of her book Fashionopolis, The Secrets Behind the Clothes We Wear. Just before the break, we were beginning to talk about how some people in the fashion industry are finding more sustainable and just ways of making clothes. Let's continue with that theme. Another thing I was impressed by is that there's something called right shoring. That is, we've been offshoring our production of clothing for, you know, a generation, as you say, since the whole NAFTA and free trade regime took hold and globalization exploded. But now people are bringing jobs back, not just reshoring, but right shoring. What is right shoring? And give us an example.
The whole offshoring movement was to cut costs in your supply chain. And so you used to produce everything in North Carolina, say, and it cost you $20 an hour per worker or $25 an hour per worker to make, say, let's say blue jeans with benefits, with, and not just benefits, but great things like you also sponsored the local Little League team, or you put field lights up in the local fields and, you know, the football field. You were part of the community. There was a corporate paternity kind of patronage that was also involved when you had a factory somewhere in America that was expected and great. And but then you had, you know, bean counters and number crunchers come in and say, why are you spending $25 an hour on these workers plus sponsoring the Little League team, when you could have everything made in Honduras or Mexico for 20 cents an hour? And so you could have, you know, you could pay 20 cents an hour and not have to pay any of those benefits or sponsor Little League teams. And so then your profits go up enormously and your stock prices go up enormously. And everybody, you know, in the C-suite is getting wildly rich, and all the shareholders are getting wildly rich. And you don't have to worry about all the responsibility of running a factory, making sure it's meeting all the health codes and the labor standards. All of that stuff, you just offload that to somebody else. Well, then you could reshore everything where you bring everything back to, say, North Carolina, but, you know, you're still paying people poorly. You're not really, or you could be putting it in these sweatshops we talked about in LA, or you could right shore. And for me, right shoring, what I describe in the book is that you take one of those old abandoned factories from the 1990s during this exodus of manufacturing, and you come in, and they've mostly, all the gear and the machinery is most, for the most part, been sold off for scrap anyway. You refit the whole thing with state-of-the-art, super high-tech machinery that is just like that you would never put in other if you'd kept on working, because who's going to shut down their factory for 3 months, throw everything away, invest all this money in new stuff, lose the money? You know, that's a huge investment. But if it's just sitting there empty, you can come in and kit out a brand new 21st century factory. And because these states and countries lost so many jobs, in the 90s and have so many people on the dole, they're giving really nice incentives, financial incentives, tax breaks, grants to any companies that do want to come in and do this so that you will come do this. And I went to visit one of these factories in England in a 19th century cotton mill that had been sitting empty and hadn't been a cotton mill since the 1950s. And some entrepreneurs came in and kitted the whole place out with brand new technology and has it spinning. They're spinning cotton in old Cottonopolis outside of Manchester, where this all began in the 18th century. And for the first time since the 1970s, they're spinning cotton in Manchester again. And it's just fantastic. The air is clean. It's silent. The cotton's beautiful. Then they spin it there. They send it to a local dyer. They send it to a local weaver. And then they're making things that are sold in the UK. When I was there, it was socks for the company Marks and Spencer. So they're keeping everything in, the whole ecosystem is within a half an hour of each other, and then being sold through the country that's not very big. And that's right shoring. You're bringing it back to thinking local instead of global. You're saving money in things like transport, and you're empowering your local economy and your neighbors and your friends, and bringing money and jobs back to where you live. And it's just less of an impact on the planet, which is great.
Now, I want to ask you something. Come in here. This is wonderful news.
It's wonderful news.
And you have talked about, you know, how cheap clothing is, the fast fashion, and how, you know, really, if you think about the environmental and the human impact, it isn't cheap at all. It's very expensive. But the prices are low. You talk about some of these reshoring firms, and I actually went online to some of them. I'm not the one that you just spoke of, but some of the others, where the clothing is, you know, it's like $400 for a T-shirt, which is a lot more than $8 for a T-shirt. And certainly people can pay more than $8. But, you know, more than half of Americans don't even have $400 in their savings to cover an emergency.
I know. I'm a writer. I know. We're among the worst paid out there.
So how can people who aren't, you know, it always seems like to do the right thing, you have to be rich. How are we going to connect the dots here to create a sustainable clothing industry that people can still afford? I'm not saying they're going to be spent, you know, paying peanuts for it, but that they can afford, it's higher quality, they'll keep it for longer, but it's not $400 a T-shirt.
No, of course not. Well, like I said, when I went to the factory in Manchester, they were making socks for Marks and Spencer. Marks and Spencer is sort of like Sears. So, you know, it wasn't luxury. It wasn't Louis Vuitton socks. These were just nice, nice cotton socks. But because they weren't having to ship them all over the world, the price in other places, you know, the cost built into producing those socks balanced out, because they weren't having to employ and ship and pay duty and all the rest of it. It was all being done right there.
Right, right. And, you know, I actually went online and I did buy 4 pair of socks from an American firm made with organic cotton here in the U.S. And they were just $10 a pair. I mean, I paid $40, which, you know, to me, for cotton socks that are comfortable and are going to last a long time, that's fine.
It's better to pay $10 for a pair of socks that will last you a year than $2 for a pair of socks that will last you 6 weeks.
Exactly.
What is it? A penny?
It's penny wise, pound foolish. If you pay pennies, basically you're going to end up spending more money because you're not going to get what you pay for.
Money. Yeah, that's exactly it. And, you know, I always say to people, this all sounds a bit ambitious. It sounds scary. It sounds like, how can I afford that? But we can have positive impacts in our supply, or the way, you know, what I call conscious consumerism, that we just think before we shop or do, and it will have a positive impact on humanity and the planet. Things like, okay, if you have the choice between buying cheapo organic or cheapo socks that were made in China and been shipped all over the world with conventional cotton and all those chemicals. And all online, you could buy a 5-pack for $10, or you can buy one beautiful pair that's made by a fellow American in a great factory with cotton that was probably grown in Texas or California, natural dyes for the same budget, and it'll last you longer. Just if you do that one little pivot, you're supporting somebody in an endeavor that could grow really well, really fast. If you have the option between paying $35 or $40 for the jeans made of synthetic indigo and conventional cotton that are junky and have terrible impact, or you need to, and you're going to have to replace them in 6 months, or you buy the really good new Levi's with the natural indigo for $70 that are going to last you forever, double down, get the good pair, right? And save some room in your closet too. My daughter's still wearing my blue jeans from the 1980s because they were good jeans when I bought them.
That's great.
You know, so you can do, and you can do other things, like you can just wash your clothes with cold water and on the short cycle instead of boiling them, and just wash your jeans like really not very often because they don't like to be washed. Remember, they were passed down from miners to miner without ever being washed. And, you know, that will just give your clothes a longer life if you just do it on the short cycle versus the spinning them and boiling them and using warm or cold water instead of hot water. Little things like that. You're saving electricity. You're lowering your water bill. You're lowering your electric bill. You're giving your clothes a longer life. They don't fade. They don't fall apart. Little things like that will just have such a huge impact on.
You're listening to Writer's Voice, and we're talking with Dana Thomas about her young readers' version of her book, Fashionopolis, The Secrets Behind the Clothes We Wear.
On the planet.
And buying used. So talk about the new market in used clothes.
Oh, well, it's huge. Used clothes, you know, back when I was a college student, I would go to the Salvation Army and find these groovy things from the 60s. You know, that were, I love the dollar skirt rack, right? But they were very period and they were kind of, you know, not great pieces and whatever. You know, now I go to the Salvation Army with my daughter and she, on the dollar shirt rack, she's finding Ralph Lauren shirts. So that tells you right there that, you know, these brands, in the 30 years I've been covering the fashion industry, these brands have grown to be such huge global companies that they're producing so much more. Like I said, we now produce 100 billion items a year that, you know, you will find Ralph Lauren in the Salvation Army store because it's just everywhere. And there's only so much stuff you can have in your closet before you throw it away because they're encouraging us to burn through clothes. So you will find a lot of clothes that have never been worn with the price tag on them, good clothes, in secondhand shops for a fraction of their new price. When I interviewed Stella McCartney for the book, she said, yes, of course, my clothes are expensive. I'm a luxury fashion designer. But listen, you can buy it on the sale. You can buy it on the sale of the sale, or you can buy it on resale. And what she does is if you donate your old Stella McCartney clothes to a place like The Real Real, you get a $100 credit, or maybe it's at her store. I can't remember. I have it in the book. You get a $100 credit towards something new at Stella McCartney. So you're, you know, she's encouraging you to put the clothes back into circulation, which is great. Don't ever, please, throw away clothes in the trash unless, you know, unless they're really, really ruined, and then cut them up and turn them into rags to polish the silver. But please don't just like say, oh, I don't like this dress anymore and put it in the bin. At least take it to the charity shops, so if they don't sell them themselves, they can sell them on the market for resale and bring some money into their charities. Think about reselling it yourself on something like The Real Real or one of the other secondhand retail, or even eBay or Etsy. Keep the clothes in circulation. Give them a second, third, and fourth life, because unless they're really worn out, you know, they want to keep living and being out there too. Fashion doesn't just die. It wants to keep going to the party, man.
Exactly. You know, my granddaughter, who's going to be turning 18 next month, She buys almost all her clothes used online.
Yeah, my daughter does too. And she also shops my closet. She's finding all sorts of gems. She's like, Mama, the 90s are back in fashion. I'm like, well, there's a whole bunch of 90s over there. So go help yourself, kiddo.
That's great. Well, Dana Thomas, your book is Fashionopolis, The Secrets Behind the Clothes We Wear. And I also know that you are just now starting a new podcast. Tell us about that, The Green Dream.
I'm starting a new podcast. It's called The Green Dream with Dana Thomas, and it's about all things sustainable and helping you to green up your life. So we want to take the scariness out of this whole climate talk. You know, when you read pieces in the major weeklies or in the newspapers, it seems like it's a lot of gloom and doom and scary stuff. You know, when we listen to, I mean, I love Al Gore, but when he starts talking about rain bombs and you know, and colossal fires and torrential storms and destruction, you're like, you want to put your fingers in your ear and go back to bed, right? So we're not doing that at all. We're going to talk to you about nice things and things like I just said, like how you can green up your life by just washing your clothes on the short cycle in warm water instead of boiling hot. And you know, where you can find things like, you know, green or environmentally healthy mattresses that aren't going to clog up our landfills, or how you can, you know, what is the difference between natural fragrances and commercial fragrances? It's going to be kind of fun. And my first guest is going to be Oliver Jeffers, the children's author of Here We Are, Notes for Living on Planet Earth, and how he's become this sort of voice in the climate movement, but in a nice, friendly and child way, which perfectly links us back to Fashionopolis, the young reader's edition. It's all the piece.
Well, that's great. And I'll be signing up for that podcast. Well, Dana Thomas, it's just been great to talk with you about this book, Fashionopolis. I highly recommend it for grown-ups as well as kids. I know there's a grown-up version.
There is a grown-up version.
But if you want the shorter, sweeter version, do the one for kids. It's really got a huge amount of wonderful information. Thank you so much.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
In addition to Fashionopolis in two versions for adults and kids, Dana Thomas is the author of Deluxe, How Luxury Lost Its Luster, and Gods and Kings. She hosts The Green Dream, a podcast focused on sustainability and human rights. Find links to her podcast and excerpts from Fashionopolis at writersvoice.net. Well, the more things change, the more they stay the same. We heard Dana Thomas reference that homily earlier in the show, and it came to mind today as I was listening back to my 2008 interview with security and energy analyst Michael Clare about his book, Rising Powers, Shrinking Planet, The New Geopolitics of Energy. At the time, Russia was about to go to war on Georgia. As I said then in my introduction, we spoke about an emerging new world order featuring the rising petropowers like Russia, the former Soviet republics, Nigeria, and the Sudan are holding more and more of the cards. And with global warming, a world armed to the teeth, and democratic principles in retreat, the stakes are getting higher and higher. In 2008, George W. Bush was president, and we were still heavily mired in Iraq, another petro-war. The U.S. was then an energy importer, which is not currently the case, but Clare makes the point that security lies in developing clean, renewable energy. And that's just as relevant today.
And now, in May 2008, when we see that the supply of petroleum is dwindling and that the cost of acquiring it from these foreign war zones is so high, we have nothing to fall back on. We're trapped in our addiction, and we're going to pay a very high economic price for our folly and failing to take measures to move away from petroleum. In my mind, this is the greatest error that we've made is failing to move rapidly to the development of petroleum alternatives, which other countries like the Europeans and the Japanese have been doing.
Then we turn to Russia as a petrostate, its then war with Georgia, and what that meant for democracy and the world.
The Russians are very keen to become to come back as a major player in the region, and Vladimir Putin has been very skillful at playing the energy card very successfully. He has forged close ties with Iran. Russia is the world's number one supplier of natural gas. Iran is number two. And they've talked about joining forces in a natural gas cartel.
And what would that mean?
Well, it would mean that as oil becomes more scarce, that natural gas would be the main source of energy another decade from now. And they intend to control the supply or dominate the supply of natural gas between them. And this would give them a lot of geopolitical influence in the world as America's star begins to dim, or at least that's the way they see it. Europe is becoming increasingly concerned about this development because Europe relies far more than we do on natural gas as a source of energy. They're very dependent on Russia. They're very worried about the political implications of that. They're trying to reduce their dependence on Russia, but they're not being shown an ability to succeed at this. So they're trying very hard to form independent links with the former Soviet republics of Turkmenistan and Azerbaijan, but they're being thwarted by Putin's success at preempting them in this and America's incompetence and our complete preoccupation with Iraq. This is what they call the new great game, alluding to the great game of the 19th century when the British were then the great power and competing with Russia for influence in this area. We're seeing the same thing again, but it's a new ball game with China now a major player in the area, Russia once again a resurgent power, the United States, but the United States immobilized in Iraq. A very interesting picture.
Interesting picture?
Interesting, scary, dangerous. One of the danger areas we might mention is the Republic of Georgia, where Russia has been meddling in the breakaway regions of Abkhazia and South Ossetia, threatening to assist the leaders of these breakaway regions to declare independence or to join Russia the way Kosovo has declared independence from Serbia with the backing of the West. And Putin has been giving the message that just as he doesn't recognize Kosovo's independence as kind of retaliation, he will encourage the breakaway status of Abkhazia and South Ossetia. Georgia says this is illegal, is turning to the United States for support. I bet most listeners don't know that there are American troops in Georgia on a training mission located not very far from Russian bases in South Ossetia and Abkhazia. This could be the spark for a military clash between the United States and Russia that could lead to who knows what. It's a very dangerous situation emerging there.
Talk about the role of Georgia in this emerging geopolitics of energy.
Georgia is important not because it harbors much oil itself, but because it is the throughway for the BTC pipeline, the Baku-Tbilisi-Ceyhan pipeline that the U.S. helped build. This was a pet project of former President Clinton. It carries oil from Baku and Azerbaijan from the Caspian Sea through Georgia to Ceyhan on the Mediterranean coast of Turkey. And it's a way to get oil from the Caspian Sea region without going through Russia. So this is a strategic American asset that's threatened by Russian forces in the vicinity. That's why we have a training mission in Georgia to help protect the BTC pipeline. So you're quite right to ask how this fits into energy geopolitics.
And Russia's the real winner here.
Russia's a big winner in the new world of energy geopolitics, where the possession of energy is the key to political success. Russia has a surplus of oil and natural gas. It has a lot of coal and uranium. It's in a very strong position in the New World Order, whereas the United States and China are both energy have-nots. And so we are both turning to these countries, to Russia, Kazakhstan, Azerbaijan, with our hat out, begging for whatever we can get from them.
Russia, in fact, has, if anything, moved away from democracy. Putin is a kind of strong man, the strong man of Russia. Talk about the connection between resource power and lack of democracy.
I think this is an inevitable consequence of resource-based economies, because in most of the world, resources, especially oil and natural gas, uranium, things like that, are controlled by the state. And in the case of Russia, there was some attempt at privatization, but Putin has reversed that. So whoever controls the state controls the one major source of wealth. In Russia, Gazprom, the gas, natural gas monopoly, is state-owned, or majority state-owned. Gazprom is the largest and richest corporation in the world. It's worth more than any American corporation now. It's state-controlled. The chairman of the board, Dmitry Medvedev, is scheduled to become president of Russia on May 12th and to name Vladimir Putin to be the prime minister. So Gazprom is essentially taking over the Russian state. In effect, Gazprom is the Russian state, and it has the world's biggest pipeline network, and Putin is using Gazprom as an instrument of Russian foreign policy to intimidate and coerce the states on Russia's periphery that depend on it for oil. So oil and natural gas become instruments of political power. They also become instruments of great wealth for whoever controls the state. And those who have that control have no inclination, no incentive to share that power with anyone else. So the last thing you're going to have is true democracy in those countries. So what's true of Russia is true of Nigeria, is true of Angola, is true of Kazakhstan and Azerbaijan. It's true of all of these countries.
Those were clips from my 2008 interview with Michael Clare, professor of peace and security studies at Hampshire College. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight to your inbox or subscribe to the podcast and the newsletter. And follow us on Twitter at writersvoice, all one word. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.